My name is Mike McCafferty, and I am a god. I stand before you a fearsome trickster-like god, and you will amuse me. For I am Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek. And I don't want you to leave. Please. Please don't leave me here alone.
Are you insane?
They are insane!
Hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
Inaccurate. But Red Frosting.
It does like you.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
How you doing, Mike?
Let the lesson begin. Welcome to Olympus. Captain Kirk.
I'm sitting here in my office in Space Station Regula 1, alone, on Thanksgiving Eve 2016. When you listen to this, you may listen to this on Thanksgiving Day. Maybe you will as you're going over the river and through the woods or through the hoods to whomever you want to see. And you're going to be with friends and family. I tried to get friends to be on this podcast tonight. The doctor was unavailable. She's stuffing envelopes for something. And I just didn't have time to get people together. And I haven't had time to do this. So I'm doing this alone tonight. And so I dug through some of my old ideas about deep dives I wanted to do. And I came across this one idea that's been scaring me. And I'm going to do it tonight. I took a stab at this about 2 months ago. And I don't think I nailed it. So I didn't publish it. I recorded the whole thing. I had it edited. I had really ready to go, but I just didn't feel strong enough about it. And so tonight, I'm going to take another stab at it because it feels appropriate tonight, Thanksgiving Eve 2016, to talk about it. Because it is about being alone, and it's about a specific kind of loneliness that's found in Star Trek for a specific genre of character. So for this podcast, I present to you The Lonely Gods of Star Trek. Part 1. Fear. It is apropos that this is the first part of it, and it is titled Fear, because, of course, I did earlier say that I was afraid to do this podcast. This podcast feels big. It feels a little more dissertation-ish for me to dig into. And normally when you're doing podcasting, you have someone to bounce stuff off on, you know, you can make mistakes, you can, you know, have a good time and laugh, and whatever mistakes you make in the podcast, they're your own. But when you're doing a podcast like this, you're completely exposed. And I will tell you that I record some of these things. You might not realize that, but I do over and over again trying to get it right because of fear. And like I said, I was afraid to do this, but interestingly enough, it is fear which started this, the actual character. So about 3 or 4 months ago, my friend Brian Weissel, who's soon to become a big star, texted me and wanted me to watch a Voyager episode. Now, you know my struggles with Voyager. I guess I left off around season 4. I guess 7 of 9 kind of turned me off a little bit, you know, a woman in a tight suit kind of thing. Well, women in tight suits don't turn me off, but you know where I'm going with this. The sort of sexism of it, the sort of blatant, let's put a cute girl on the show, kind of tarnished it for me. And to be honest, I was a little burned out. All I'd been watching was reruns of Star Trek Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. And by the time Voyager hit, I was just burned out. I'd been like 10 years of Star Trek, and I was ready for a break. And the inclusion of 7 of 9 had kind of given me that out. People tell me that once she showed up, once she got into her groove, the show got great. I'll go back and watch it. I promise you that. But this was actually, I believe, a second season episode. And it's called The Thaw. The Thaw is not a great name for this show. It has nothing to do with anything that is pertinent to this episode, other than the fact that our intrepid Voyager crew, not our intrepid crew that voyage, arrive at a planet. Planet Cole, I believe is what it called it on Memory Alpha. I don't think they ever named the planet. And it sounds like, you know, the place where you buy, you know, cheap clothes, the Coles. But they go there and they find these scientists who are frozen. They are frozen because there was some sort of environmental disaster, and they're waiting to be awakened. And they say, hey, you got to stay away. As soon as this disaster is over, we're going to wake ourselves up and everything's going to be cool. But the disaster's already been over and they have not thawed out yet. Okay. Title established. Okay. So our Voyager crew decides to butt in because that's what you do, right? You go in and you just kind of like mess around with people's lives when they're sleeping. They find out that these scientists are in a sort of matrix-like world they've created, and they're sort of stuck in it. And then B'Elanna and Harry Kim, they go inside there, and they find the scientists in a weird Mardi Gras world, populated by like clowns and all sorts of weird characters from Cirque du Soleil. In fact, they got characters from Cirque du Soleil. There are people of diminutive height. There are jugglers. There are tumblers. And then there's Michael McKean. Well, not Michael McKean, but Michael McKean playing the role of fear. The manifestation of fear. And that in enough is an interesting idea. But the reason that Brian wanted me to watch it is because his personification and this characterization and this writing of this was so reflective of a character from the 60s of Star Trek and earlier too. This character was bouncing off the walls, chewing up scenery. He was actually the manifestation of these scientists' fear. And so as a result, he was crazy. He was sort of like Batman's Joker. 1960s Batman's Joker, Cesar Romero playing the Joker, and Michael McKean was chewing up the scenery. But in addition to that, he was also the god of this virtual world. These scientists could not escape it, and neither could Harry Kim or B'Elanna Torres. Is that her name? B'Elanna Torres? Yeah, that's it. B'Elanna. I just call her B'Elanna. And this fear character didn't necessarily torture these people, but he wanted to have fun with them. He wanted to scare them and also play with them. What an unusual character this was. And so throughout the episode, he is conversely having fun with them and then antagonize them. And anytime everyone wants to leave, he can read their minds with a slight lag. He punishes them for it. He punishes them by bringing up their innermost fears, right? He is fear, and this is fine. This is a great conceit for an episode. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Harry Kim actually says that, and maybe that should be the title of the episode, Fear Itself, because that's what it was. They're facing fear itself, but they call it the thaw. That's on them, not me. And had they just destroyed it somehow, defeated it somehow, still a pretty good episode. Some of the visuals on this episode are great because they do harken back to the 60s. They have big, colorful sets. They oversaturated the color grading of it. They have a turntable at the very end of the episode, so it feels like the whole world is spinning. Because eventually, Janeway figures a way to defeat this creature, this construct, this machination of our own minds by creating a VR creation of herself that tricks it. And had it just like screamed like Armus had done or something like that, that would have been fine. But listen to the final exchange between virtual Janeway and fear.
You know as well as I do that fear only exists for one purpose, to be conquered.
She tricked me.
Did she? Or was a part of you actually hoping to be defeated? Isn't that why you allowed Captain Janeway to come here? Because you sensed she had the power to subdue you?
No. She lied. It was very un-Starfleet of her.
Starfleet captains don't easily succumb to fear.
What will become of us? Of me?
Like all fear, you eventually vanish.
The lights begin to fade on fear.
I'm afraid.
I know.
Drag.
And in a tight shut of fear, the lights go out. And we see end credits. No final shot of Voyager pulling away. No resolution. No denouement. We don't need one. Because this isn't Voyager's story. This isn't Janeway's or B'Elanna's or Kim's. This is Fear's story. And for 43 minutes and 45 seconds, we were led to believe that this was a villain. That this was some terrible infant which had trapped our heroes. And all we had to do was stop it, destroy it, fix this glitch, and we could walk away from the episode and be happy. But in those last few seconds, the writers pulled a fast one on us. And they made us do something we didn't expect. They made us care for this creature. Listen to this again.
I'm afraid.
It's the one thing you didn't expect to hear from a creature like this, from this one-dimensional creature, for it to reach through the screen and touch something within you, inside your heart. Something that transcends science fiction. It's a storyline that we all have, that we're afraid. We're afraid of dying. And by doing that, it engenders empathy within us. And everything that came before that, all those 43 minutes and 45 seconds, are now thrown into sharp contrast because we suddenly see this character a different way. And that is the Lonely God. Part 2. The gods build the gods. The Lonely God was an idea which was very prevalent in the original series, TOS. I can think of three solid examples, which I'll be presenting here in a few moments. But before we do that, I want to go back a little bit and talk about some of the foundational reasons why this became such an easily repeated theme. Star Trek was created in the 1960s. Now, when we say the 1960s now, we have instant images of hippies and the drug culture and Woodstock. But we have to remember that the 1960s came after the 1950s. Spoilers. It's true. And it also came after the 1940s. And these were two very large decades which affected the people who would make Star Trek more than the 60s would later on. In the third season, we would see the 60s, the hippie culture start to manifest itself a little bit in the storylines. It was being written by men, mostly, D.C. Fontana being one of the exceptions, who had gone through the 40s and the 50s. So we have to take a look a bit at that as well. When we talk about the 1940s, of course, we're talking about World War II and the effects afterward. It ended in 1945 with the dropping of the atomic bomb. Now, there are two things which came out of this. One is that America had a sudden dominance over the world. This horrible, savage conflict had finally ended, and we found ourselves king of the hill. Can you imagine what a nation would feel like where it had suddenly been vaulted to the very top? How does that affect the psyche of a nation? Added to that, and I think you all know that this is probably even more prominent in science fiction, is that we had dropped the atomic bomb, not once but twice, on the Japanese forces to solidify those victories. Not only had we won conventionally, but we had won using a device which no one had ever seen of or conceived. Power so unbelievable, so unimaginable, that it changed everything. Think about that. Think about how people must have felt when it was announced that a bomb had been created and dropped which could obliterate an entire city. Welcome to the future. It is not a far stretch to take those two different things, being the winners of World War II, and I put a caveat out by that because obviously history is written by the winners, and that we have this unimaginable technology that even we don't understand. We have, in some sense, become gods. As we move forward into the 1950s, the United States enjoyed an unprecedented amount of prosperity. All the production we've been doing for the war had now been turned inward, and we're producing all sorts of incredible things, cars and refrigerators and television sets, and GIs who were coming home were suddenly reaping the benefits of surviving and coming home and having families. It was a glorious utopian time. And as this science fiction became science fact, we began to dream forward. Forward. We can do anything. Watch some of the movies of the 50s. Watch these spaceships launch into outer space and conquer the universe. because we could, because we knew that we were that good, because we defeated evil and we became gods. Now, in lockstep with this became the birth of science fiction. With all this new technology, science fiction writers and writers who were turning to science fiction began to explore and question what all of this technology meant. We were hurtling faster and faster towards an unknown destination. And while the rest of the world thought it was a paradise, sometimes the science fiction writers began to question and say, where could it really go? One of those writers went by the name of Rod Serling, probably one of the greatest American writers of the mid-20th century. His Twilight Zone, and even before that, some of his Playhouse series, are some of the best writing you're ever going to read. Go get a teleplay of Rod Serling and prove me wrong. And one of the things he really introduced to the American population was the twist at the end. Now, as we look at modern narrative, there's a twist at every single end of every single serialized show, right? Lost kind of rebooted it. And now every single show that you see that has a serialized nature has a cliffhanger at the end of it, has a twist. Rod Serling was the one who popularized that and made it more of a conventional idea. We all know what the Twilight Zone is. I don't have to explain too much of it to you. But you get the gist, right? You understand how we're taking the idea of a god and putting a twist on it through science fiction writing. The last bit I'll say is that as we move into the 60s, a lot of these writers and a lot of these show creators, like Gene Roddenberry and some of the other writers, were now moving into their 40s. Now, someday I'll move into my 40s. Oh, wait. I'm almost there, or maybe I'm almost out of it. I can't remember which. It doesn't matter, but I can tell you that when you reach a certain age as a man, you begin to question who you are and what's going on. And everything that you survey, everything that you can do suddenly starts to turn. And even though you may be the king of your domain, you may be the lord of your castle, which is your wonderful two-bedroom house on a tract home in the 1950s and 1960s, suddenly you start to think, is that all there is? Is there anything else? And as I look around, what do I really have? I think that all three or four of these things I've mentioned set the stage for what would become the birth of the Lonely Gods. Part three, Gods That Are Not Lonely. Star Trek, the original series, and TNG, and a little bit of Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise, has a lot of gods. Again, as we're building forth this idea that Americans feel as though they are becoming more godlike, it became apropos for us to see what it's like up there. Let's see some of these false gods and see if we can knock them down with our human, with our American ingenuity. And most of the time, we did. And sometimes we encounter these lonely gods, these gods which at the very end had these little tugs at our heartstrings, but a lot of them didn't. And so, here's a list of some of the other gods which didn't make the cut. First, we have gods that experiment. These are kind of like the asshole gods. We're talking about the Metrons from Arena, where they just pluck the Gorn and Captain Kirk and they make them fight because they just want to see what's going on with that. And at the end, they just kind of leave because, like, oh, you showed compassion. Good job. How about those Excalibur planet rock creatures who got Kirk and Spock together with Sarak and Abraham Lincoln to fight Kalis and Colonel Green and Genghis Khan? And then when they were done, after Kirk and Spock won, they're like, well, good job. We just wanted to see how that worked. There's also Nigilus, the creature in TNG who pops out of that cloud and says, I'm going to kill everybody, and then I'm not going to kill everybody, and I just wanted to experiment on you guys. These are the gods that wanted to experiment on us, and once they did, they left. Not lonely gods. There's also gods that want something. How about the godlike character from Star Trek V? Bring the ship closer. That guy, that weird big Santa Claus guy there, he just wants the ship. The Talosians, they want to eat our memories. They want something very, very specific. Even though they are sympathetic at the end, they want something very specific from us. So these are all creatures that fit the godlike mode. They have godlike powers to us. But in the end, we don't feel anything for them. Not like we feel for these next three godlike creatures. Part 4, The Lonely Gods. Okay, here we are. Who's a lonely god? Who do I consider to have this lonely quality to them? Well, let's start first off with Charlie X. We've talked a little bit about this in some of the earlier podcasts, but it's worth going back over again. Charlie X is a guy, a kid named Charlie. He's about 16 or 17 years old, played by about a 35-year-old man. Welcome to the 1960s casting. And at first, he seems like a normal kid who was stranded on a planet, somehow managed to survive. But then it's seen that he manifests these incredible powers. He can control the ship. He can transform people into lizards or make them go away or make their faces disappear. He is definitely a person with godlike powers. He has been changed. And he means to take the ship, again, like the god from Star Trek V, and take it and do whatever he wants. As we talked about Twilight Zone a minute ago, I can invoke It's a Good Life, starring Bill Mumy, who would later on play Will Robinson in Lost in Space, being a child who also had incredible powers and terrorized an entire town, sending people away to the corn, turning them into the jack-in-the-boxes. You've seen the Treehouse of Terror episode with The Simpsons. That's where that came from. And Charlie X is a very close cousin to that. Probably they stole a little bit of those ideas. And at the end of The Twilight Zone, Bill Mumy's character just keeps on going on. He terrorizes the town, and we are left to brood upon the fact that this is a hell that these adults live in. And Charlie X is pretty much winding up to be that episode, right up until the last minute. Again, right up until the last 3 or 4 minutes of this episode, when suddenly a spaceship arrives from Charlie's planet. And Charlie is suddenly terrified. And we see this elderly gentleman's face hovering in space, addressing Charlie.
Take me. I can't even touch them. Janice. I can't feel. Not like you. They don't love.
Please. I want to stay, 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 stay.
And Charlie X vanishes from the bridge. Instead of our crew being overjoyed, they all feel a sense of loss. Because what at a moment ago seemed like their greatest threat had now suddenly become a child. Become a teenage boy who was filled with fear. He had so much power, but at the end, he was so afraid. And he was so lonely because he couldn't even touch them. And now he is relegated to a life alone. Part 5, Apollo. Okay, in part 4, I said the lonely gods, making you think I was going to lump all three of them together. I lied about that. That's okay. Because I wanted to talk about this guy too. In Who Mourns for Adonis, which as a kid I thought was Adonis, the Enterprise arrives at a planet and a giant hand reaches out and grabs them. If you watch Star Trek Beyond, they make allusions to that, to the illusion of that, when they talk about one of the ships, the Franklin, maybe being grabbed by a giant green hand. That's where that comes from. In this episode, Who Mourns for Adonis, a giant green hand grabs the Enterprise and a dude's head pops out who claims to be Apollo, Greek god. The crew beams down and they find this little tiny Parthenon-like shed-like thing. We've talked about this episode a little bit before. It's a good episode. And this guy, played by Michael Forrest, who I've met, I've had dinner with, great guy. He is the real deal. He really was in Greece 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, with his buds ruling over that area of the world. Now, McCoy kind of scans him and figures out he's probably just an alien with a weird gland that can channel energy, that can transmute stuff. But for all intents and purposes, he's a god because he can grow really, really big and can shoot lightning out of his hands. Eventually, though, science starts to prevail, and they figure out that his powers generate through that little tiny Parthenon-like shed, and they have to destroy it because Apollo wants them all to stay and to play the lyres and to tend sheep. And as nice as that sounds,
I would have loved you.
We can't do that.
As a father loves his children.
So Kirk devises a plan to distract and annoy him, and Spock breaks through the force field, and they fire the phasers on his Parthenon shed, and they destroy it, even though he's shooting lightning out of his fingertips, saying, "Stop! Stop!" It is badass. It is a god versus a starship, and you know what? The starship won, and damn it, we did it. We defeated this god. But then we see that he's in tears. Not because we destroyed his stuff, but because we didn't want to be with him anymore. We didn't want to worship him. And that's all he wanted. So he realizes that his time is done, and that it's time to join his friends who have faded away forever. He grows to giant size here.
You were right. Athena, you were right. The time has passed. There is no room for gods. Forgive me, my old friends. Take me. Take me.
And Apollo ceases to exist with a vocal effect very similar to Charlie X. We're going to hear that one more time. And the crew, they're not overjoyed. They're devastated. Listen to McCoy.
I wish we hadn't had to do this.
So do I.
I wish we didn't have to do this. So do I. Up until this very moment, Apollo had been the adversary, the thing keeping our crew from getting back on the ship, the thing threatening to enslave them, to infantilize them. And yet when they finally defeat this worthy foe, all they can feel is pity and sympathy. He's in tears. All he wanted to do was go back to what he knew, was to rule us the way that he ruled us a long time ago, with a degree of benevolence, a degree of patriarchal love. But we couldn't do it. And so he had to disappear like Charlie X. Out of the three, this is by far the most emotional, because he's so sad. He's been waiting for so long. And at the end, the realization is that the waiting was for nothing. Part 6, The Trickster, Part 1.
Welcome to an island of peace on my stormy little planet of guns.
What happened? Fill me in.
You disappeared from the bridge after Sulu. We've been looking for you for 4 hours.
You must excuse my whimsical way of fetching you here. But when I saw you passing by, I simply could not resist.
Okay, so the last three examples I've given you have been very maudlin and very moody, and they're tragic characters to be sure. I mean, each one of them meets a tragic end of basically vanishing from existence. And defining tragedy, we all know that they're coming to some sort of fateful end that we can see, but they can't. And it's only at the last minute that they realize it. And what makes it a tragedy is that it is that emotional realization that, oh my gosh, this is the ending for me. That's very Greek. I have a master's degree in theater. But William Campbell playing the Squire Trelane is something of a different beast. Now, we've talked about him a little bit before, played by the excellent William Campbell, who also played a Klingon later on. He is an over-the-top great actor who just chews the scenery with this role. For a long time, I thought he was Liberace playing this role, but he's actually William Campbell. He did a really damn good job. Now, this characterization, if you watch it now, it is really over the top, but if you put it in contrast with shows like Batman and Lost in Space, it is right on par for those really big Baroque-style villains. who have such a sense of humor that they're just so much fun to watch. The Squire of Gothos also fills in with the lonely god in the respect that we meet Trelane, and he is indeed this gothic character, this general, retired general, who has probably the strongest powers out of all of the characters we've met so far. He can move planets in the way of the Enterprise. He can transport people down instantaneously. He can freeze them. He can do whatever he wants. He can create an entire building from nothing. Now, if this character sounds very similar to another character we're going to see in Star Trek Next Generation, you're on the right track. Let's put a pin in that, but let's keep on dissecting Trelane, who is not what he seems. And he's so anachronistic with what's going on that it puzzles the Enterprise crew more than it terrifies them. I mean, he pulls them down and we're suddenly in this 17th century castle, and he's playing the harpsichord, and he's dressed in these 17th century outfits, and he's addressing them with a very proper way of talking, this 19th century foppish way of addressing everyone, which I love. We call it fool speak. If you ever want to talk to me like that, say, "Ah, my good friend, you will delight me." Because it's so over the top and so much fun, but it baffles the Star Trek crew. Even more baffling is the fact that he's getting a lot of the facts wrong. He's so powerful, and yet he doesn't understand that he's been seeing the Earth 400 years ago. He's off on that. And he doesn't understand why they're not going along with all of his fun. The Enterprise crew try and try again to get away from this creature, but they cannot. They disrupt his machine like they did with Who Mourns for Adonis. This actually came before that. But it doesn't work. His power is within him. He can move planets. They try everything they can, including Kirk bargaining to go on a hunt where he is the fox and Trelane is the fox catcher. And if he escapes Trelane, he'll let the ship go free. And he does sort of do that. He does sort of defeat Trelane, but Trelane's not going to have any of that. This is a god who is so powerful and does not play by the rules. And when Kirk breaks his sword, he gets upset. Kirk slaps him. He almost looks like he's going to cry. What is going on with this guy? And then, right at the moment we think that all is lost, where Kirk can't defeat this creature because he is just far too powerful, and then somebody else shows up.
But you saw. I was winning. I would have won. Honest.
No, Trelane.
No, Trelane.
I would.
Captain, we regret that the life paths of yourself and your companions have been disturbed.
Who are you? Who is Trelane?
You must forgive our child. The fort is ours for indulging him too much. He will be punished.
We would not have let him intercept you had we realized your vulnerability.
And there it is. There's a trope right there that Star Trek had defined. Trelane is just a child. He's like a 6 or 7 or 8 year old child who goes outside to play and finds a colony of ants. And so he gets a magnifying glass until his parents show up and reprimand him for being so cruel and callous. Because he's saying, you saw, I was winning, I was killing those ants. No, Trelane, no, you have to go to your room now. And in a similar fashion to Apollo and Charlie X, and that's why I'm grouping these three together, he vanishes, repeating a phrase over and over again. I woulda. Now, why is he a lonely god? Because he's just a child. But this child is lonely. This child went out to play and was looking for a friend. I mean, he really wants to have a play date with the crew of the Enterprise, and he just doesn't understand that the way he's playing is far too rough. And so at the end, he has to go to his room. He couldn't play with his playthings. And that's not as sad as Charlie X or Fear or Apollo, but we've all been kids. We all know what it's like when you have to go into your room and be alone. Part 7.
Thou art
notified that thy kind have infiltrated the galaxy too far already. Thou art directed to return to thine own solar system immediately.
The Trickster.
That's quite a directive.
Part 2. Now, you put a pin in Trelane, and now you're going to take it out because we're going to talk about, I believe, his successor, Q. Now, hold on a second. You're saying, wait a minute, Q wasn't a lonely god. Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Now, I'll prove it to you in a little while. But first, let's establish a couple of things. Now, there's always been a lot of correlation between Trelane and Q, and I don't think that's an accident. It's my belief that Trelane was a rough sketch that Gene Roddenberry was working on so that he could introduce him later on as Q in The Next Generation. Now, obviously, he wasn't, you know, had any sort of preconceived ideas about this, but after 15 years, he was able to think about this and say, I want to bring a character like that, a lonely type god, an omnipotent, powerful god back to challenge mankind and to see, to test them and see what they are made of. And for someone as grounded and as responsible as Jean-Luc Picard, a character like Trelane is a perfect foil for him. So in the very first episode, they bring in Q. Q appeared in 8 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. He appeared in a couple of episodes of Voyager and 1 episode of Deep Space Nine. I don't want to talk about those because it's my belief that Q's arc is completely satisfied by the end of the show, All Good Things, which is the last episode of the last season of Star Trek The Next Generation. Just as Picard's arc ended, so did Q's. And that's important because Q is a lonely god, but he's also a trickster, just like Trelane. And tricksters are cheats, they're very intelligent, but sometimes they dispense knowledge. And it's my belief that the character of Q became a fully formed lonely god character, which reached the full circle of its character development by imparting knowledge upon our hero, Captain Jean-Luc Picard. Now, to be sure, Q starts out a lot like Trelane. He just sort of bursts onto the scene right in the beginning of the show and declares, you got to go back home. It's sort of the reverse of Trelane going back to his room. Q shows up and says, humanity, go back to your room. Don't come back out. But he's baiting humanity. He wants to see what Captain Jean-Luc Picard is going to do because they are on trial, aren't they? Just as Trelane put Kirk on trial, humanity's on trial for this. He's testing them. So in these early episodes, this is very much more of a bellicose, a warlike Trelane character. He's a lot more rough around the edges. Now, he eventually starts to get a little lighter, a little more mirthful, and at the same time becomes a little more serious. He was a little bipolar in the first couple of episodes, for sure. He tests the Enterprise crew, and when they succeed, he kind of slinks away. He comes back, and he tries to give Riker powers. And when that doesn't work, you know, he takes off. Q loses his powers. Q puts the Enterprise in jeopardy. He kills 18 people on the Enterprise when he introduces them to the Borg and says, hey, if you can't take a bloody nose now and then, you maybe should go hide underneath your bed. That is hard ass. That is not what Trelane would have done. Well, I mean, maybe he would have. This is a far more adult lonely god than Trelane was. He's a far more sophisticated god than Apollo or Charlie X. And as the series progresses, we begin to see more and more facets of him. Sometimes he is playful, like in Cupid when he sends the crew through a sort of a Robin Hood-style romp. Other times he's more aggressive, like in Q-Who when he sends the Borg after them. Sometimes he's very wise in Tapestry, where he sends Picard back in time and gives him another chance to relive a moment where he got stabbed in the heart to see if he would replicate it all over again. Throughout his 8 episodes, and it's only 8 in like 140 episodes, we see this dynamic arc being built up by Q, played by John DeLancey, expertly played by John DeLancey, whereas Trelane was so bombastic and over the top, John DeLancey underplayed everything, sublimely playing it. And it all built up to the series finale, All Good Things, where there's a time paradox, and Picard is traveling backwards and forwards through time, where we get to see the crew when they first started out the series, and then they get to see the crew 10 years into the future as he figures out that he has somehow caused the death of the universe in the past by by doing something in the future. It's a paradox. Doesn't make sense. And Q is there to watch him through it all. And somehow Picard figures it all out and solves it and saves the universe yet again. And it is here, in the last moments of this episode, in the last moments of the season, the last moment of the series, in the court where Q first put Picard, that we finally see the lonely god revealed.
What about my crew?
The anomaly, my ship, my crew. I suppose you're worried about your fish, too. If it puts your mind at ease, you've saved humanity once again.
Thank you.
For what?
You had a hand in helping me get out of this.
I was the one that got you into it. A directive from the Continuum. The part about the helping hand, though, was my idea.
You know, sometimes they cut that segment out, that little snippet of dialogue, if you're watching BBC America or other reruns. And that's too bad. Because that is the entire character arc of the character of Q, of the lonely gods. That brings it full circle for us. Look at this character when we start out. He was petulant. He was rude. He was overbearing. He was so powerful he could crush us. And at the end, we find out that he is this lonely god, cast out by the Continuum, charged with testing us over and over again, charged with giving Picard an impossible task. And yet, he lended a helping hand. Why did he do that? Because he's lonely. Because out of all the creatures in the universe, Picard and the crew of the Enterprise are the closest thing he has to friends. As I said earlier, Q is a trickster, but he's also a teacher. And I believe that at the end of his journey through these seven seasons, he imparts Picard with one last piece of advice, one last gift to him that only a lonely god can bestow.
Q, what is it that you're trying to tell me?
Q leans forward, close to Picard's ear, as though he's going to whisper something to him, but at the last minute pulls away.
You'll find out. In any case, I'll be watching. And if you're very lucky, I'll drop by to say hello from time to time. See you out there.
And Q, like the other lonely gods, fades away. He doesn't die. Doesn't go to his room. He's just gone for the show. The season's over. The series is over. Now, a lot of people would conjecture that he was going to give him some sort of metaphysical piece of information, or this is what the universe is about, this is what life is about. But as I look at Q's arc and the Lonely God's arc, I think it's far more simple. And my evidence is what happens in the scene after that. I think that Q wanted to tell Picard that you don't have to live your life alone, that you need to reach out and make these connections. You need to find people to be with before it's too late, before you fade away. Why do I think that? Because the very next scene after all of this is Picard going to his senior staff during their poker game. And for the first time in 7 years, asking to play the game with them. And they're thrilled. And he stops before he deals and he said, "I should have done this a long time ago." And that was the lesson that Q was trying to teach him. He was trying to teach Picard to reach out and make those connections and not be a lonely god like he was. They run in parallel to each other. The captain of the Enterprise, a god among the stars. And for Q, his fate may already be sealed. But for Picard, a mortal, there's still time. Time enough to reach across the void and not fade away. Wow. How about that, huh? This has taken me longer than it's taken most podcasts. It's something that I've tried once and failed, and I'm trying it again tonight, this morning, and it is Thanksgiving morning now. And I guess there's something apropos about it happening through Thanksgiving, that Thanksgiving has occurred on it, especially here in America, if you're listening from a different country. For us in America, Thanksgiving is probably the most personal of holidays because it is about being with your family, being with people that you love, making that connection. I don't know what to make of this, of why I chose to do this, beyond the idea that there was something about a lonely God and something about family, about connecting, which I'll be doing tomorrow, today, with my family and calling my family. And I won't make any sort of larger statement about that. I'll just leave it there because I'm not that smart. I'm a packlet about this. But I got through this one, and this one was tough. And I'm glad I did, and I'm glad you did. Thanks. Thanks for listening to this nonsense. We have more fun stuff coming up. I'm interviewing Carl Held, the guy who was in the Turn of the Archons, who got hit by a rock that bounced off his head. And he was at the Red Hour, eh, yeah? The Doctor will return. Jason McCarris at some point in time will return. We're going to have all these great people back. Maybe George, maybe Ryan, who knows? All sorts of fun people, because this is a fun podcast. If you're listening to this on Thanksgiving, have a great Thanksgiving. If you're not, have a great Thanksgiving Day whenever Thanksgiving occurs for you. I'm Mike McCafferty. I'm not lonely. I'm lonely right now, but I'm not lonely because I'm with you. And I just want to talk about Star Trek.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly-collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my God.